Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, we have had some extraordinary heroes, and one of them is with us, I'm very pleased to say today, for the full hour of conversation. His name is Colonel Richard Kemp. He served with great distinction in the Royal Army until he retired after some 30 years of service in places like Iraq, the Balkans, Northern Ireland, and not least, Afghanistan, where he commanded for a time British forces and worked closely with the United States military and has, as a result, an extraordinarily keen sense of what's happening at the moment. And we're anxious to pick his brains about it, not only for our own country, but for our important special relationship with the United Kingdom, with NATO, and with the free world more generally. He is the author of a terrific book, Attack State Red. He has contributed mightily to the public policy debate over many years, over both military and geostrategic issues. He has been a guest on this program from time to time. We're always very pleased to have him with us, and he turned in a absolutely bravura performance on Mark Levin's program a week ago yesterday on Fox News. And we're going to recap some of the highlights of that, I think, with him today. And I couldn't be more pleased to have Richard Kemp with us. Colonel, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you back.
Thank you, Frank. It's a real pleasure to be with you again from across the Atlantic.
Across the pond, as they say. Your perspective over there is especially valued. But let's start with your assessment of what we now confront as a result of decisions taken by the Biden administration. We'll talk about some of those in more detail, but just sort of your 30,000-foot level assessment of the effects of these decisions on, well, the free world, as I say.
Well, the implications are wide-ranging and severe. I would class this as the greatest foreign policy and military policy disaster affecting the West in living memory, probably since at least the Second World War and possibly before the Second World War. It's such a far-reaching and catastrophic situation, and for a number of different reasons. One of which, I think that the one that will impact us greatest in the longer term is the humiliation of the United States of America and NATO and all of their Western allies. We have we're facing an immense challenge to our prestige and to our influence and to our power predominantly from China and Russia, also countries like Iran, and whereby we were hoping to influence countries that may be either in or planning to come into the sphere of influence of China and Russia, the authoritarians. You know, we were hoping to entice them to come into our side, onto the side of the democratic states. And that our influence and our capability to do that is now severely undermined, because they will be looking at us as fair weather allies, not as reliable long-term friends who can be depended upon. And they will look at China and Russia as being their, probably the more reliable allies. And on top of that, we basically provoke China and Russia to go even further than they've been in recent years in challenging us in so many different areas, because they now don't see very much of a deterrent from the West or a likely reaction from the West that will be problematic for them. So that's just one of the numerous implications of this disastrous foreign policy decision.
You were in Afghanistan back in 2003, pretty much at the get-go. You played a very important role in helping accomplish some of the most important of the military successes of this very long war. Where did things leave the tracks as you see it?
Well, I think some people would argue that we should have simply gone in 2001, destroyed Al-Qaeda and demolished the Taliban. And there is a good argument for that, for doing that and then leaving. But of course, had one done that, then what do you leave? You then leave a complete vacuum waiting for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and other jihadists to come back in and fill it. So I think to an extent, we did have to remain in Afghanistan for some time. And, you know, the strategy was originally was to create some kind of government and security forces in Afghanistan that could stand on its own feet. Now, I think where that went wrong at an early stage, when I was there back in 2003, I personally witnessed the relationship between President Karzai and the US ambassador and the British ambassador in Kabul. And I attended meetings with them between them. I observed very carefully the relationship, and that relationship was one of control by particularly the US ambassador, but to a lesser extent by the British ambassador, whereby they, you know, President Karzai would basically do what they told him. They were running the roost. They quickly changed and deliberately changed that policy so that they, so Afghanistan had a sovereign government with a sovereign president who called the shots. And they basically fell in line to a very large extent with the shots he was calling. Unfortunately, he was incompetent, and all subsequent, governments were also incompetent. They weren't able to control the country. They weren't able to influence, all parts of the country or they needed to, or to, even they weren't capable of building that level of influence. And I think that, you know, we didn't really understand that. We kind of misappreciated the reality that, that Kabul is not kind of seen as a central point of many of Afghanistan. Many Afghanistan people, they are tribal people. They have allegiance to their tribes. They have allegiance to the region they come from, their ethnicity, not to Kabul, not to a central government. And therefore, some kind of different form of order was needed than the kind of centralized control that we have in our countries, generally speaking. So that wasn't probably, if it was appreciated, it wasn't acted upon. And so, you know, the President Karzai and his successors failed to operate an effective government or even develop one. And the answer would have been, I believe, would have been for control to have been retained by the United States over Afghanistan. Now that does sound, imperial almost, that you've got an imperial administration over the government of Afghanistan. But unfortunately, that does sound unpalatable, particularly to people today, but I think it was the only way in which Afghanistan could have kept on the rails, because huge amounts of the money that we gave for the armed forces, for the government, for all sort of bits in Afghanistan was siphoned or went into buying houses for these leaders, the political leaders and generals, etc., countries like Dubai in Turkey elsewhere. There was massive corruption, which of course, those people who were expected to defend Afghanistan recognized the corruption. And again, that made it less likely they would have allegiance to Kabul. So I think that was one of the two fundamental errors. I think the other one was allowing Pakistan to so effectively support the Taliban. If it hadn't been for Pakistan, for its funding, its arming, its direct military support, and orders to the Taliban, I don't think the Taliban could possibly have had such an effective insurgency. It ran for 20 years, nor could it have taken over the country now without that support. We knew that. That was known right from the very beginning. Yet action wasn't taken sufficiently strongly to change that relationship. Now, maybe it couldn't have done, but I think that was a fundamental flaw.
Well, let's explore that too, because as you say, the folly of a centralized government in a tribal society was a fatal error. But so was paying the Pakistanis to undermine us, which is what now unmistakably was taking place, is it not? That they were effectively providing both sanctuary and underwriting and training and recruitment and logistic support and the rest to this Taliban insurgency, even as we were essentially paying for the military of Pakistan, the intelligence services of Pakistan, the government, effectively, of Pakistan, all the while its principal backer, despite all of that, was our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. No?
And they remain a principal backer of Pakistan. But we effectively, U.S. taxpayers' dollars and British taxpayers' pounds, effectively were funding a war against us, a war we were trying to fight. It's absolutely incredible reality, but it is true. And it's not something that people have just realized. It's been known about right from the very beginning. But, you know, I guess the calculations taken were the strategic importance of retaining Pakistan's influence in other respects around the region. And I guess that,
well, not least the need to transit Pakistan territory to get kit into Afghanistan. No?
Right. Well, that was certainly an important factor. But I think that and various other, Britain has other other concerns as well in relation to Pakistan, not least the enormous Pakistani diaspora here in the UK. And so I think those, you know, these various factors combined meant that insufficient pressure was applied to Pakistan to deter it from doing what it was doing. And of course, you know, one of the consequences that the Pakistani come to regret of their victory effectively via the Taliban over in Afghanistan. And of course, you know, Imran Khan, Prime Minister of Pakistan, was celebrating the Taliban's victory a few days ago publicly. But I think they may come to regret it because they themselves have a very powerful insurgency inside Pakistan, which does aim to bring down the government of Pakistan. And I think, you know, the presence of the Taliban running Afghanistan, the other jihadists that will enter Afghanistan, I think that all of that will lead to greater instability in Pakistan. And that is a, you know, it sounds counterintuitive that the people that Pakistan has put in place in Afghanistan in order to have influence themselves there could well be counterproductive for them in terms of potentially bringing their government down. But that is the reality. This region is not logical in so many ways. And we shouldn't forget that Pakistan is a nuclear-armed state. If those nuclear weapons or some of them fall into the hands, or some nuclear material fall into the hands of terrorists, then that would lead to the most catastrophic situation we could expect, I think.
So true, and yet so predictable, given the circumstances, which brings us to decisions that were made in just the past few months by the Biden administration. How do you perceive the impetus behind the president's decision to depart in the way that he has and on this timing, Richard Kemp? Is this something that was totally unexpected? Was it something that we should have anticipated based upon his past track record as well as his campaign promises? And how is it that it seems to have taken so many of us, and for that matter, our Afghan allies, by such surprise?
Well, I think anybody who has taken the trouble to understand President Biden will know that he has for quite a long time been opposed to our continued presence in Afghanistan. He did support it at one stage. He then went on as vice president to oppose an increase of troop levels, and he supported the idea of maintaining a small counter-terrorist capability in the country to strike at at significant terrorist groupings and facilities and capabilities while not trying to maintain the size of forces that had previously existed. He was overridden by President Obama, but I think that's been his stance all along, and it was, as you say, a campaign promise. So I don't think it should have come as a great surprise to anyone that he would take the steps that he took, despite, I believe, as I understand it, having been strongly advised otherwise by his advisors, including his military advisors in the US. And I think, you know, the reason behind him acting so quickly, and I think his quick action of coming to a decision and then implementing it very, very fast, which led to the current situation directly. Had he Had he given the Afghan government longer to get used to the idea the US was going and to allow the Afghan security forces longer to adapt to a totally new situation, this would not have happened like this. It would have happened very differently. Secondly, he chose to withdraw at the height of the Taliban fighting season, when they are at their most powerful, instead of waiting until autumn or late autumn or winter, when they tend to have less capability, they tend to be less active. And again, that would unlikely have led to this immediate situation. And thirdly, he and his advisors, and the same goes in Britain as well, even once the decision had been taken in May to withdraw, they didn't start implementing the withdrawal. They didn't start evacuating national civilians or indeed other members of other Afghans who we wanted to get out and we've been racing and panicking to get out. None of that needed to happen. It could have been done in much more slow and ordered fashion before this evacuation. But I think the reason behind his doing it so quickly with such catastrophic results was he had to hit that 9/11 date 20 years after 9/11 for some absurd reason that I can't fathom out. He had to have that date. It was a random date. Yet to him, I suppose he felt it was going to add to the political benefit he got, the electoral benefit he got from pulling all the troops out of Afghanistan, which was, of course, his primary objective for doing it in the way he did, i.e. to gain electoral advantage in the midterms, which is actually a shocking motivation and a disgraceful motivation when you consider that many, many people's lives, safety, and just way of life is completely at stake.
There are a couple of military decisions that I particularly wanted to get your take on, Colonel Kemp. One is the decision to remove the military personnel before the evacuations were even undertaken. I think it's accurate to say, certainly not very far advanced. And secondly, to foreclose the use of Bagram Air Base as a place through which you could, if not conduct most of those evacuations, certainly you could have projected power and helped protect what was going to flow from this withdrawal. Just quick thoughts on both of those and how they've contributed to the present crisis.
Well, I read a book once called On the Psychology of Military Incompetence, and I think both of the points you make would have been given a complete chapter in that on their own. It's unfathomable, really, in a way, that you would pull out virtually all of your troops or large numbers of your troops only to have to put in even more than you pulled out to evacuate all the civilians. It's just incredible. And withdrawing such a lot of important equipment as well that you need to conduct this operation. Closed Bagram Airport was incredible. I don't, a lot of people have been saying that it would have been better to evacuate all these civilians from Bagram. I don't think that is probably true. Some of them could have been maybe evacuated from there, but at least you'd have two options, not just one. And having the benefit of Bagram in order to launch military operations from to protect the operation in Kabul Airport. I mean, that is just common sense. And I think the reason why these decisions were taken was because was a complete misappreciation of what was likely to unfold. And the same mistakes were made here in Britain, exactly the same mistakes. And that was a failure to plan for the worst case. Clearly, they were planning for the best case, these both of our governments. And they didn't take account of the fact that the Taliban could advance so quickly and the Afghan government would collapse so quickly. They simply didn't do so. They were expecting a nice orderly withdrawal, which could have got, one of the intelligence estimates quite recently made by the United States and echoed by Britain was that it would take something like 9 months after US withdrawal for the Taliban to take over the country. And they expected that. They didn't. And even if you don't expect it to happen within just a couple of weeks, you certainly need to plan for that. So it is absolutely incredible. I wasn't present, but I was told that there was an off the record briefing that took place in the Ministry of Defense not long before all this happened, the British Ministry of Defense, that is, where people present at this meeting, at this briefing, were told, when asked whether we should be planning for a very quick collapse of the Afghan government, some very senior officers saying, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen like that. So that shows the mindset. And it shows, you know, two things. Firstly, a failure of intelligence and appreciation of the capabilities of the Afghan forces. And secondly, a failure to, irrespective of the intelligence, to act on worst case.
It's been said by people who have been supporters of the Afghan army and its, you know, sacrifices to date and its capabilities, such as they were, that what actually happened to them was not simply that they suffered the body blow of, you know, collapsing morale as the United States and its allies bugged out, but also that in the process, the U.S. government cut off the support that was absolutely essential to them performing their mission, whether it's logistical support, resupply of ammo, the contractor support, most obviously air support, gave them mobility in some cases, but also you know, air-to-ground fire as needed. Again, as a military man who's very familiar with the lay of the land and the character of the enemy, is that a fair point that argues that it's all the more outrageous that one would have adopted this best case scenario under such circumstances?
It is outrageous, and it's grossly irresponsible and negligent. And I think you know, when the Afghan National Security Forces, the army in particular, were trained and organized and equipped along U.S. military lines and British military lines. So quite a heavy dependency on technology, including, you know, helicopters, fixed-wing aircraft, armored vehicles, some pretty sophisticated sensors, etc. And many of the contractors supporting that equipment, in other words, technical support to keep it on the road, to keep it going, to service it, and all that sort of stuff, was withdrawn. So how do you get trained to rely on certain sophisticated military assets, and then they're suddenly just taken away from you, so they don't work? You know, after a couple of flights, the helicopters don't fly anymore. And then, as you mentioned, the air support. You know, the air support was still there, but it was significantly diminished. And in some cases, you know, I've read of Afghan, you know, U.S. aircraft flying overhead with Afghan soldiers asking for air support and being told that they've been forbidden to provide it when they were in grave difficulty in battles that were taking place. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I certainly read an account by an Afghan general of that being the case. Sounds right. And so, you know, I think that was an extremely significant factor. And for President Biden, in those circumstances, when he'd effectively sabotaged the Afghan army, for him then to accuse them of being cowards, he said in a speech, they won't fight for themselves, why should we fight for them? These people are not cowards. They're extremely brave soldiers. In the last 7 years, 50,000 Afghan soldiers have been killed fighting the Taliban. That's two-thirds the size of the British Army in its entirety. Now, how can they be cowards? They like all soldiers, they require leadership, they require motivation, they require, above all, they require morale. Morale is the most important single factor in war. And, in fact, it's more important than all the other factors combined. And the morale effect, the morale impact of the U.S. pulling out, and I say the U.S. rather than Western force, because above all, the Afghans depended on the United States. And the morale effect of them leaving was just devastating for an already demoralized Afghan national army, which was badly supplied, which often didn't get paid, which knew its government was corrupt and wouldn't look after. And so the final guarantor of not being overwhelmed by the Taliban just disappeared. And you can imagine the shattering effect on their morale. So, you know, I think...
Especially when our forces disappeared from Bagram in the middle of the night without any advance notice at all. Colonel Kemp, you've talked about the extent to which we inculcated in the Afghan army this dependence on technology. We tried to sort of make them into a mini-me, you might say, of the U.S. military, which has resulted in... the abandoning of apparently tens of billions of dollars worth of very sophisticated gear that is now in the hands of the Taliban and evident Pakistani hands, Iranian hands, presumably Chinese hands, Russian. Can you give us some appreciation of what the implications of that kind of transfer of advanced weaponry to these various adversaries of the United States is likely to prove to be?
Well, I think many people have focused on the effect of essentially equipping a terrorist army with some of the most modern, sophisticated equipment and vast numbers of explosives, artillery shells, artillery howitzers, and small arms machine guns, rocket launchers, missiles of various
sorts. Night vision goggles.
I think people focus on that. I don't think that is really the major thing. It is, of course, a great concern, but I think a lot of this stuff, particularly some of the sophisticated sensors, the helicopters, some of the other equipment, is going to be very difficult for the Taliban to actually operate themselves, even if they wanted to. And yes, quite a few, a significant number, I think, of the Taliban, or sorry, of the Afghan security forces, has actually defected to the Taliban now. They're working for the Taliban. So some of them who were trained to operate the equipment might be able to do some of it. But I suspect it's not the major problem. It's the major problem with it is one that this is a further significant source of income for the Taliban when they start selling it to various other actors in the region. And secondly, the technological aspects, some of this equipment will certainly go into the hands of countries like Russia and China, who will be able to reverse engineer the equipment and then use it against us. In other words, they're using our technology to attack people who are our allies, or indeed even at some point to attack us.
At the very least, to be able to counter our use of such technology effectively.
Exactly. And, the obvious thing to be doing, quite clearly, this equipment, it would have been the final nail in the coffin of the Afghan forces if the Americans or the British had suddenly just removed all this equipment as they went, so that the Afghan National Army, while it was still doing some fighting, had no equipment. That wouldn't have obviously been right. So it was really, given the circumstances, there was no option. But now there is an option, and where concentrations of equipment can be identified, they can be struck from the air and destroyed. And they should be, in my view, as much as possible of it should now be subject to U.S. airstrikes.
Right. Well, hopefully, once our guys are out, it will be the next step. Let me ask you, if you could, to address, and you sort of touched on it in your opening comments, Richard Kemp, the political override of our military personnel. Is it your assessment that the president was getting better advice than he took with respect to some of these key decisions, whether it's, the Bagram issue or the evacuation of all of the military or the leaving behind vast quantities of gear, and that he simply, for his own reasons, whether they were, victory lap that he intended to take on 9/11 or under some other calculation, disregarded that advice? Or is it your sense that he was getting bad advice from our military? You mentioned, some of the people who were telling the Ministry of Defense in your own country that we had at least 9 months to watch this play out with the Taliban taking over. But what's your reading on, based on what we know now, of decisions that the military, or recommendations, I should say, concerning decisions that our military was offering to the president?
Yeah, what I was mentioning was the decision to withdraw completely from Afghanistan. I believe that he had counter advice from senior military officers in Washington that suggested that wasn't the best option, and he didn't obviously take note of that. In terms of more tactical decisions, like exactly when you withdraw who and which bases you close when, I don't know actually the extent to which those are the kind of decisions that a U.S. president actually gets personally involved in. I suspect probably not too great a detail, which would suggest that these were bad decisions taken by military commanders. I don't know that for sure. And it may be that they were simply given, timelines in which things had to be achieved and they had to do it. I don't know that, but I do know, and the same goes for Britain, I do know that there should be an independent inquiry into how all this came about, into who did what decision, and not so much to carry out a witch hunt, but to learn lessons from it, because this has been such a great disaster. It's essential that what happened here does not ever get repeated again anywhere else.
Amen to that. I wanted to ask you about a fundamental piece of this, it seems to me, both on the political side and on the military side. And that is the idea that you can end wars by quitting an endless war, as this one has been described as. Paul Wolfowitz, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense under President George W. Bush, wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal, I don't know if you saw it, to the effect that, as you put it in the headline, the forever war hasn't ended. Again, you've sort of alluded to this, but tease out, if you would, Colonel Kemp, what the likelihood is that we're going to see specifically the community that we've talked about from time to time in the past. I call it the Sharia supremacists, not just the Taliban, but others like them who adhere to this Islamic doctrine of Sharia and seek to impose it on everybody else through jihad, will actually perpetuate this war. In fact, presumably intensify it, both in the region and beyond.
Well, it's a very good question, Frank. I think, firstly, the greatest victory for jihadists, and I'm not just talking about this century, I'm talking, in the last few centuries, it's the greatest victory for jihadists. And it's greater, for example, for them than 9/11. Because 9/11, perhaps was possibly the result of intelligence failures. Maybe it could have been prevented if certain things had fallen into place. We've all read the analyses of how 9/11 came about. But this is much more than that. There were a lot of lives lost on 9/11. But it was a failure of intelligence. This is a failure of intelligence. It's a disastrous failure of policy, of strategy. And, its consequences are going to be immeasurably greater than the direct consequences of 9/11. So I think, this has achieved what Al-Qaeda set out to achieve on 9/11, which was bring down the Twin Towers, force the U.S. to invade Afghanistan to destroy the people that were responsible, in fact, destroy the U.S. and humiliate them on the world stage, which is exactly what Al-Qaeda planned to do. That's what they wanted to do. That's exactly what's happened, except that it's taken 20 years longer probably than they expected. I think they expected they'd be able to annihilate the U.S. Army in Afghanistan within probably a few months or even a year. It's taken 20 years, but it's happened. And this has given the most immense shot in the arm for jihadism everywhere. There are many jihadist movements around the world that are trying to bring down the governments of the countries they're operating in or to gain independence for areas. There are more jihadists as well who are operating in our countries, who are trying to attack us, who want to attack us from within our own countries. These people have all been given a huge shot in the arm. They've been given this is a gift for their recruiting, for their funding. There will be vast sums of money now as a result of this pouring into the coffers of jihadists everywhere. Many, many new recruits. And they've been given, they have effectively been re-energized in their campaign. So I think we can expect now to see a significant increase in the power of jihadists around the world. And I think the second implication, when you were talking about the sort of forever wars, which President Biden, in between blaming President Trump for the decisions that Biden himself took and the actions for which he alone is responsible, in between President Trump, he sort of speaks then most of his time muttering about the forever war. But actually, what about forever? The casualty rate, the level of troop contributions in Afghanistan, the cost in recent years has been relatively small. I think it's been a couple of years, something like that, since the last Americans died before the ones that were killed last Thursday. So it's not for the US and for the UK, etc. It's not a really hot war. Now, if the decision to pull out had been not occurred, it might have been necessary to put more troops into the country. And I think that probably would have been necessary, but not vast numbers more, just relatively small numbers. And by a relatively small US presence and with the Afghan army continuing to fight with the US in place, I think this war could have been gone for many more years and contained the real problem that it seeks to prevent, which is the use of Afghanistan as a safe haven for terrorism. So you know, all we have to do, you know, talk about 20-year war. What about South Korea? The Americans have been in South Korea since the 50s, since the war didn't end there at all. It's still going on, but very not a hot war. We've had U.S. garrison in Germany, since 1945, and they're still there. We've had, you know, there are numerous other examples around the world of this. So why is Afghanistan and Afghanistan alone the never-ending war? It's a political slogan which is actually meaningless, and I think was driven to a large extent by the media in the U.S., in Britain, and elsewhere, and also by our enemies outside, you know, by countries like China and Russia, who, of course, have been pushing the same line. It is such an important issue, Frank, and it's so important that as much understanding is shared about this issue as possible, because it is very complicated and it's very opaque. So I think, you know, the more any of us can do to try and understand it and share our understanding, the better. But I think now we have two jihadist nations at states in the world who are basically founded in both cases on jihad, and use jihadism, terrorism, and will extend their use of that over coming years. And that is, we have one that's the Shia jihadist state of Iran, and we now have the Sunni jihadist state next door to it of Afghanistan.
And as you say, it may turn out that there's a new arrangement that will bring Pakistan into that fold in a way that raises the stakes, much as we're concerned they're about to be raised by the Iranians with nuclear capabilities in the hands of these jihadists. It's a moot point, I guess, for the moment, but just as a matter of interest, Richard Kemp, did you look at the proposals that notably Eric Prince was making for a much smaller footprint for American personnel in Afghanistan, a continued presence, to be sure, of volunteers or contractors, if you will, to do much of the support for the Afghan military that was previously provided by Big Army, as we call it here in the United States, but that would have reduced greatly the cost, would greatly have reduced the number of presumably principally special forces personnel that would have been in country, and made what you just said a moment ago about, you know, a low level, you know, conflict, a much less burdensome one for the American taxpayer, and have kept in check, arguably, the sorts of forces that have now been unleashed and greatly emboldened.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really is the template that I would like to have seen in place. Of course, it's not going to happen now. But I'm not particularly in favor of using contractors as fighters. I think contractors have a certain amount of, you know, there's certain things that they can do. But I think when it comes to fighting on behalf of a country like the United States or the UK, I think for moral reasons, it's actually important that it is the armies of those nations that do the fighting as far as possible. I wouldn't exclude the idea of contractors becoming involved in it. But I think that, you know, if you're fighting a war that is a war of national significance, I think it needs to be fought by the nation's armies above all. But I think the reason, one of the plus points for using contractors is that, for whatever reason, there's not the same kind of emotional response if a contractor gets killed as if a US soldier gets killed, for example. And I think that's one of the kind of logic points behind that argument. And I think, you know, one that led to this was the loss of national support for these wars, really, when body bags were coming back. And that was, you know, that was that was certainly over here. That was the point at which we lost more support for the war than ever. But it is the duty of our political leaders to counter that, and they can do so by explaining why these sacrifices were not in vain, why we had to fight and lead the people to support it, and that is their job. But they failed, particularly, I don't know about in the US today, not sure what the balance was, but certainly over here in the UK there was a real failure of political leadership in this war by prime ministers and governments not being able to persuade the people to stay behind it. And partly that was a result of left-wing wokeism, because you know, previous governments in Britain were unwilling to persuade the people it was necessary to fight and kill people. What they wanted to do was talk about humanitarian aid and women's rights. That's all they wanted to talk about.
Yeah. You know what, Richard, I think partly this is a function of a lack of clarity about what the point of the exercise was, too. Let me turn in the closing 9 or so minutes that we have with you to sort of 2 overarching points that I think really are vital to understand both where we are at the moment and where we go from here. One is the issue of having emboldened enemies. And we've talked, of course, about the Sharia supremacist specifically, but you've mentioned several times China and I guess Russia should be thrown into the mix as well. Give us your sense, sir, of what it means to have the Chinese and the Russians take away from all of this a heightened degree of confidence that they can act with impunity. What are the practical consequences of that likely to look like, and how serious a danger do you think that represents, not just again to the United States, but to freedom-loving people around the world?
Well, I think it's a really good, and there's I don't think there's any two countries in the world more gleeful at what happened here than China and the United States, and that's one because of their, it's partly because they will benefit, particularly China will gain enormous economic benefit by Afghanistan's national resources and integrating it into its Belt and Road Initiative. And in fact, in both countries' cases, by having opportunities to actually get at the West through their influence in Afghanistan. And they will certainly exploit that as much as they possibly can. But, in terms of, you know, the sort of bigger picture, I think China and Russia obviously have ambitions to expand their geographical control and expand their influence around the world. And they've looked at Europe as being an irrelevant. Europe is just there. They know Europe is not going to do anything about actions that they take, really, any serious counteraction. But always there's been the US there, and the US has always been thought to be a strong power that potentially will counter things that they do, for example, in Taiwan, in Ukraine. And that's always been a deterrent against going too far. They pushed the envelope in both cases quite a long way, including, Russia in Ukraine and China in the South China Sea and elsewhere. So they pushed it, but I think they now probably see the US as sort of, for the time being at least, on a par with Europe. So these aren't really problems. So now, perhaps now is the time to act more strongly in the areas that they want to act strongly in, with the view that there won't be any serious reaction from the US. So I think we might now be in a pretty dangerous period with both, with effectively the US seriously undermining itself and NATO having also been totally humiliated by this thing. I think, the fact that Ben Wallace, the British Defense Secretary, tried to recruit NATO countries to join a British-led coalition to stay in Afghanistan after the US had left. I'm not sure how serious he was about that, but he says he tried to do it, and not one single NATO member said yes, which tells you a lot about the power of NATO. So I think, I think that's the situation. We're entering a globally very dangerous situation with America apparently, almost neutralized now. And it's vital. I think it is vital that work takes place now to repair the damage that's been done to the US reputation and to repair the damage that's been done to NATO and to ensure that the relationship between Britain and NATO, which is important in its own right, doesn't get too badly undermined by this. It took the US from the fall of Saigon in 75. It took the US 15 years to regain its position in the world when it successfully liberated Kuwait. So 15 years, I think we've got a longer task ahead than 15 years, but we need to start work on that right now.
Especially in light of the dangerousness of the adversaries that we're now facing. But just to wrap this up, talk a little bit more about the special relationship and for that matter, other allied partnerships.
Yeah, well, I think the NATO is one of the most important organizations for peace in the world. Albeit that it's been a bit rickety, really, since the end of the Cold War. The NATO has been struggling to find its place in the world, and one of those places, in fact, the main place that it has actually operated as an alliance is in Afghanistan, and that has been a disaster as a result of this withdrawal. So NATO is, and I mentioned before that pretty much no NATO members, in fact, not pretty much, but no NATO members have been willing to go into Afghanistan or to remain in Afghanistan without the US, which really does suggest that these members are window dressing and that NATO is just the US, really, with a few other flags flying around their quarters. We've known many US presidents, including President Trump and President Obama, have strongly criticized NATO's lack of commitment to the alliance. But it is nevertheless, in the face of the challenges we face from China and Russia and other countries, NATO is a very important alliance, and it is necessary to try and restore its credibility and actually go beyond that to make it an even more useful alliance than it was before, and that's not going to be easy, because I think that there is well set in now a pacifist mentality, ideology in Europe, and Europeans are very reluctant to actually flex their muscles at all, which mean, of course, they're prey to countries like Russia and China. And the British-American relationship, I think, is so important in the world. Britain, America up until now really, in the West, has really been the only significant player that has military force and is willing to use it when necessary. It is very much in a unique position. Britain is the only other one, I think, that it can always, whatever the situation, be dependent upon to stand with the United States of America. Obviously Britain is a very small entity compared to the US, has very much limited and increasingly limited military capability as our forces get cut back. But nevertheless, is apart from military virtue, is politically very important in various operations around the world. So I think in the interest of defending the values of the West against the creeping and increasingly rapidly creeping counter values that are being pushed towards us from China in particular, and to a lesser extent Russia, I think that relationship, that alliance, remains vitally important. And this has split the UK and US to an extent. And I think it's partly a desire, knowing that British leadership is also to blame, a desire to displace that blame onto the US for political survival purposes over here.
Such important insights on so many different fronts. Richard Kemp, I'm so grateful to you for taking the time to explore this with us at length. Thank you for the service you've rendered, not just to your own country, but to really the cause of freedom, both in uniform and that you are rendering these days as a speaker, as a commentator, as a pundit, perhaps, but as a very knowledgeable authority on particularly the military and, as I said earlier, geostrategic implications of decisions that are being made. We hope you will come back to us again soon with updates on all of this. And in the meantime, that you will stay well. You are a great patriot leader in this war for the free world, and we're grateful to you for your friendship as well as that very important service you render, sir. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us as well. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. I had the privilege of co-hosting a special edition of Steve Bannon's War Room Pandemic on Saturday. One of its most disturbing insights was Steve's concerning a U.S. Northern Command disclosure that the Biden administration had been planning on relocating Afghan nationals in this country since last April. That helps explain why it is that over 100,000 of them have been extracted from Kabul Airport, compared to less than 6,000 American citizens. That preference means many of our countrymen and women likely will be left behind in Afghanistan when the evacuation soon ends. It remains to be seen what terrible consequences happen over there. No less ominous, though, is the prospect that there will be among the large numbers of Afghans admitted into this country without proper vetting some who wish to do us harm here. This is Frank Gaffney.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.